From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on September 11th, 2001. It's 18 years ago now. The series of four coordinated terrorist attacks led by Al-Qaeda killed nearly 3,000 Americans. In an opinion piece for the New York Times titled, "The World 9/11 Took From Us," writer Omer Aziz remembers being an 11-year-old boy when the attacks happened. As a Muslim, he says his life from that point forward was shaped by the events of that day. He says, quote, "I tried to distance myself from people who brought destruction to America's cities and came up against the twisted perceptions that Americans had of brown people. September 11th marked the loss of innocence, the abrupt recognition that I was different, would always be viewed as different, and that the stakes of this difference could be life and death," end quote. He goes on to describe what else he felt changed, from airport security to public policy to what he describes as violence to language. He wonders if 9/11 will become an abstract historical fact for younger generations who did not live through it, the equivalent to what Pearl Harbor or the Vietnam War is to millennials and some boomers. He writes, quote, "What would I tell them if I could? They will only ever know the paranoid and terrorized world that the September 11th attacks gave us," end quote. Well, members of Gen Z have learned about September 11th through family members, or sometimes first through school curricula. Those who are currently 18 or around 18 were just infants or not even born at the time of the attacks, and their younger peers, yeah, we're talking about an entire generation now growing up who did not live through it. And for them, they've never known a world not affected by 9/11. What about people who were on the cusp of adulthood at the time of the attacks? Those 18-year-olds are now 36. They've lived half their lives in a post-9/11 world. How have their perspectives about world issues changed? It's a question raised by our city newspaper colleague, Rebecca Rafferty. She's 36 years old. She says she spent a lot of time thinking about this question. She collaborated with us on this hour where 18 years after the attacks, we talk with current 18-year-olds and current 36-year-olds about their impressions and perspectives of politics, religion, foreign affairs, and more, how that's all been shaped by 9/11. And I'd like to welcome our guests in studio. Samiha Islam is a senior at Brighton High School. She'll be 18 in just a few months. Samiha, welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Ty Gagnon is a local improviser, 36 years old. Welcome back. Nice to see you here.
Good to see you.
Another 18-year-old, I think, Ariel Mahoney. Are you 18?
No, I'm 19.
19. So recently 18, sophomore at Nazareth College. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And a guy a little bit older than 36 is Sarir Fazli, who is the past president of the Islamic Center of Rochester, but not only knows a lot of 18, 17-year-olds, there might even be some in your own family, huh?
Almost. I do have a 17-year-old.
Well, welcome. Nice to have you back here.
Thank you for having me.
This is not necessarily a conversation about where you were on that day, and you know, not to denigrate those kind of conversations. They're important. They bring us sort of together. But they've been sort of had this week. This is more a conversation about what we think changed after that. And I want to start with Ty and Sarir before we talk to a 17-year-old turning 18. We talk to a woman who's 19 about where they first learned about 9/11 and what that impression is like, because this is a world that's always been the case. Ty, for you, you were 18 on 9/11, and what was the change really or what was the biggest change in your life post 9/11?
I came from a very small town and was coming to Rochester for college, and I'm like, oh, sweet, sort of big city for me to explore.
That's adorable.
Yeah, yeah. And 2 weeks into college, the attacks happened. And so for me, I think one of the larger changes was my world expanded to, I have to think globally about every topic that comes up now. I can't afford to just sort of be in this little shell of small town America, you know, kind of going out into the world and taking baby steps. Like, there's no baby steps anymore.
You grew up in a family that is largely Christian?
Not especially, but I was pretty extremely Christian at the time.
That's interesting. So mm-hmm. So that was, in your teenage years, a personal direction you pursued?
Mm-hmm.
What led you in that direction?
Frankly, like a social need. I was often friends with people who were older than me. They all left, and the people who were left at school that I could hang out with and be friends with were the very fundamentalist Christians.
And so now, here we are, Ty. I've talked to you on this program in the past when we talk about things like humanism, skepticism, atheism. I did not necessarily know that 9/11 at least had an impact on your own Christianity, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't overnight. Take me through that.
No, it wasn't overnight. It took a number of years. I think the biggest component for me was realizing how radicalized thinking and extreme ideologies, regardless of the religion that it's a part of or the not religion that it's a part of mm-hmm. or the politics that it's conjoined with or whatever, how much of that sort of avenue of thought I had been going down unknowingly, and that was something that I really needed to address and I needed to think about. And going to a Christian college, there were plenty of opportunities to hear a whole range of really fairly disturbing things and some, you know, positive things as well.
Disturbing in the moment or disturbing upon later reflection?
Both.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so over the next few years, is it the kind of thing where the more you thought about it, the more you sort of doubt chipped away at it? Was there a moment or a day you woke up and you said, that's not me anymore? I can't go in that direction?
Yeah, I think it, in terms of sort of really sort of extreme fundamentalist thinking, I think it was pretty clear pretty quickly that that was unsustainable for me.
Mm-hmm.
I think it takes a lot longer to actually root out all of the, you know, kind of fundamental assumptions that you're making to transform the way you think. So that took a number of years. But I think it was probably even just my sophomore year coming back from break that, you know, only a year later that I was able to say, like, yeah, that's not, definitely not for me anymore.
Do you think at the age of 18, if you had considered yourself a moderate Christian, that you wouldn't have been impacted by 9/11 in the same way with your faith?
Oh, I'm not even sure how to answer that. I think I considered myself a moderate Christian. I didn't know that.
It doesn't actually sound like you did.
So on reflection, I, you know, 18 years beyond that, yeah. I would say I was a fundamentalist. At the time, I would not have said that.
Interesting. Okay. But so this is hard to sort of prove a negative, but I think if you really would have been sort of an occasional Christian or whatever, sort of a large population of occasional churchgoers or people are sort of pick and choose what they like about Christianity, but maybe don't read every text or adhere to every part of Scripture, do you think that you wouldn't have been impacted as much?
I think for me personally, I tend to be somebody who is skeptical mm-hmm. and who's willing to do that self-reflection. So I'm not sure if I would have been. I can tell you that I had classmates who were either moderate sort of Christians who became more faithful, they probably would have said at the time. You know, and I don't want to speak for them what they might say about it now.
Sure. But it was 4 years earlier, you were only 14 years old, or not even, when the Oklahoma City bombing happened.
Mm-hmm.
Had you been 18 going to college, going to a Christian college at Oklahoma City, do you think that event would have impacted you in the same way?
Yeah, I think so. Because that was, that along with Columbine were pretty fresh on my mind.
Mm-hmm.
When 9/11 happened.
All right, I guess you would have been 12. I'm doing math here. So maybe less formed and less thinking deeply about ideology. But it sounds like the conclusion you eventually drew was that extreme ideology of any flavor was not something that was something that maybe even scared you, that you wanted to move away from.
Absolutely.
And you still feel that way today?
Yeah, I do. I have a pretty strong aversion.
Let me turn to Sarir Fazli, who was 31 years old, if I'm doing the math, Sarir.
Yes, that's right.
2001. And, you know, your family was growing. You're thinking about the future. What do you recall changing in the short term and then in the long term?
In the short term, we really, I had been in practice, in the practice of law for about 5 years. And prior thereto, I had amazing faith in the system, especially in law enforcement, from all levels. I had often heard narratives of the federal bureau's reach, the U.S. Attorney Office's overreach. And quite honestly, ignorantly enough, I had discounted those basically as complaints that otherwise people wouldn't make if, you know, if they were innocent, so to speak. Immediately after 9/11, the overreach came home to the Muslim community. To this day, I can't imagine seeing some of the cases that we saw that were based on flimsy lack of evidence or trumped up evidence that was concocted, people being ensnared in alleged crimes that otherwise they would have never even thought of committing. They were enticed into doing things, encouraged. We saw so many different things in immigration. We saw so many different things happening, even on our own land, with something as what I would call extreme as the Patriot Act, where even your library reading materials were no longer safe. So in the short term, it was a pretty bad body blow to see what was happening in a place where there was supposed to be liberty and justice for all. All of a sudden, the justice component of that was seeping away, and it was a call to action for many people to realize, you know, that something has to be done, or it's going to be over before it starts. The Constitution, I still say today, was the first victim after 9/11.
David French is a conservative writer, writes for National Review, among many other publications. And he commented this week that there was so much fear after 9/11. There was almost a consensus that it was inevitable that our country would get hit again. And what he means is in a large-scale attack in which hundreds, if not thousands, would die, that we had entered a new era, that terrorism was going to become a regular part of life, if not regular, not weekly, and maybe not monthly. But his point was, it's, to him, remarkable that 18 years later, there has not been another attack anywhere close to that scale. He credits law enforcement, intelligence operations, and the way those various agencies have worked together to prevent that. What I would ask you is this, Sarir. I don't doubt that there's a lot that we don't know. And Barack Obama himself has said his first week as president, you learn a lot about what nobody knows and how harrowing it can be and how difficult decisions can be. But at the same time, I wonder if the hysteria post 9/11 reflected an unreality, and that our fear that inevitably within, in particular, the Muslim community, that extremism and terrorism would be bred and created in homegrown cells. We have a lot of talk about sort of these cells hiding in plain sight in America. If most of those fears were entirely overblown, and we've now had enough time to determine that.
I mean, you've seen anecdotal episodes where either you have a shoe bomber or some other things that are happening, and these are the people that have been led astray, so to speak, or misled into thinking they were doing something in the service of some greater creation. I still to this day don't know why it took 9/11 for the intelligence agencies and other parts to work together. You were just talking about Oklahoma City. Oklahoma City was a homegrown local domestic terrorist attack. It didn't come from abroad or overseas. So if we were going to start picking and choosing events that were going to start shaping American law enforcement's view of terror, however you want to define that word, it should have started there. There was a prior attempt, as I recall, on the World Trade Center before this. They attributed to the blind sheikh.
93, yeah.
Yes, 93. And even at that time, there was smoldering evidence that something is going on in some capacity. But to start your so-called war on terror after 9/11, when you could see pretty clearly that things were happening much before either the blind sheikh or even in Oklahoma City, it was new. It should not have been news that the intelligence agencies and the different arms of law enforcement had to start working together. Because today, I don't just see it as being, you know, law enforcement cooperating and communicating with each other as being the reason why there has been no attacks. I just think that it's a different time, it's a different place, and the hysteria created by the events of 9/11, those things don't exist anymore. And I think you really have to reconsider the whole equation on what it was that may have led to those things and how we are today in America. It has led to more education than ever, those events, not just in the Muslim community, but beyond our community. It's led to a lot more civic engagement and understanding. Unfortunately, the bar associations have become overly active in trying to prevent further encroachments on civil liberties and on how the law works. And it's been, I still think, 18 years later, it's still a work in progress.
You have a daughter who was born shortly after 9/11?
About a year later, yes.
What do you tell her about that? And is there a part of you that sort of aches for her, knowing that she doesn't get to grow up in a world where there wasn't this widespread fear?
You know, I think the fear that they see today is much different, unfortunately. The terror specter, of course, is always there because you can't get away from it in the news. But when you see things going on around the world that are somehow still focused on your community, the Muslim community at large, whether it's things in Palestine, things in Kashmir, all over the world, the amount of violence that exists at Muslims or involving Muslims, for them, it's a weekly or a monthly thing that hits them. It's not the, you know, cataclysmic event of 9/11, but some people will say that these things continue to be the aftermath of that. So trying to teach or mold, you know, our children based on those events as well as, you know, events that we see every day, it is definitely a challenge. But I think these events, they make us open our minds and they make us teach our kids to be thinkers rather than reactors.
Sarir draws that line, that question between why 9/11 in 2001 and not Oklahoma City for some of the response of law enforcement, the Patriot Act, et cetera. So the reason I asked Ty if he thinks he would have reacted the same way had he been 18 with Oklahoma City, and his answer was yes. It wasn't about being scared of Muslim terrorists. For Ty, it was looking at what he saw as extreme ideology, which happened in 95, it happened in 01. I want to talk to Ariel Mahoney, who's a sophomore at Nazareth College and 19 years old now. Obviously, no memory of 9/11 as a one-year-old now, but when's your first memory of learning about it?
My first memory of learning of 9/11? I probably learned about it in, like, elementary school, but my first impactful memory was probably when I was in middle school. We were learning about 9/11, and, like, the teacher just got really emotional. And I think that emotion was what impacted me. Because when I was in middle school and high school, I became friends with people a part of the Muslim community, but also was a regular church-attending Christian. So sometimes those parts of my life clashed with each other because you're at church and you hear, like, this way is correct. But then I'm with these friends and I laugh with them and cry with them, and that's not what you're telling me is not how they are. They're just people. So I think I continued to struggle with that throughout high school and college.
So it sounds like what you were hearing then mm-hmm. was some of the stereotyping and fear that might have been the carryover from 9/11, you think?
Yeah.
But your friendships informed you that some of that fear was misplaced.
Yeah.
Your friendships still exist today.
Yep.
As a historical sort of moment now, how do you look back then at 9/11? I mean, you're an adult now. You've never really grown up in a world where that didn't happen in this country. I mean, I suspect you actually don't think about it a whole lot because you didn't really live through it. But what do you think about it as a historical moment? What comes to mind?
I think more about the people affected. And I think a lot about the Muslim community as a person of faith. You often see different religions clashing with each other and everything. But going to college and becoming even more a part of other communities, I found that inclusivism was so important. And I feel like our generation's job is to kind of dispel some of that stereotypical fear that exists and see that we're all human.
That's actually really important and beautiful stuff. Let me turn to Samia Islam, who's a senior at Brighton High School, turning 18 in a few months. Obviously, didn't live through 9/11 either.
No.
What's your first memory of learning about 9/11?
I think it was in third or fourth grade in my religious school on the weekend. So I was at the mosque with a bunch of my other Muslim friends. And I think it was like the week of one of the 9/11 like anniversaries.
How old do you think you were?
Maybe 9, 10, mm-hmm. maybe less. And I remember the teacher was telling us, like, 9/11 is this week. And people, you're going to see stuff on the news. You're going to hear people trying to, you might hear your school friends saying that you're dangerous, that you're a terrorist. And they said, if anything happens, just walk away from it. And that's the earliest that I can remember.
Was that an appropriate message? Did you feel like that was helpful?
At the time, no, because I'm not really the kind of person that likes to walk away from things. I like to see it through to the end. And fortunately, nothing happened that week. No one said anything to me. I saw news reports, but at school, everything was fine. But what would have been more impactful is teaching why people have misconceptions like that, which, you know, probably would have been difficult for a 10-year-old to understand. But I don't think that walking away and letting other people continuing to think the way that they do and harness bigotry is an appropriate way to deal with any situation.
You wear hijab today. Have you always worn hijab?
No. So I started wearing the hijab when I started high school, so like 3 years ago.
Interesting. Okay. And has anyone ever sort of identified you as Muslim because of how you appear in public and said anything derogatory to you as a result of their assumptions about you?
So before or after?
Well, I mean, I guess both.
So before, my last name is Islam, so if I wanted to hide the fact that I'm Muslim, that's not really an option. In public, when it's just me, nothing's ever happened. When I'm at the airport with my family, my mom has worn hijab for many years, so airport security, she always takes longer to get through. That's just been a reality for us. And then in school, before I started wearing hijab, everyone, you know, there was a lot of misconceptions. Your last name is Islam. So does that mean your family's like super Muslim? What does that mean? People would come to me when we had units about Saudi Arabia and the Middle East in social studies and be like, so why does everyone in Saudi Arabia, you know, why do all the women cover up? Why can we only see their eyes? Why don't you do that? Your last name's Islam. And so growing up, I definitely became very well-versed in knowing my history, like my religious history, because I never wanted someone to come and ask me or a question in kind of an aggressive manner and not know what to say. Like that was something I was always preparing myself for, but fortunately it never came. After I started wearing the hijab, out of school, nothing really happened. In school, overall, the climate was good, but you know, certain individuals do feel certain ways. I had heard people say things behind my back. The only direct confrontation once I heard someone asked me, you know, why do you look like ISIS? And it was dealt with appropriately. Like, it was handled. But, you know, I remember I was so upset when that happened. Like, I think it was like the first 2 months of school. So I hadn't been in school for very long wearing the hijab. Like it was new for me. I didn't think too much of it. I still felt the same. I didn't think that I had changed. I still had all the same friends from middle school. I still, you know, took relatively same classes. And the fact that someone would turn on me like that just made me so upset. And I remember my brother and I on the bus home from school, I was telling him about it, and I was like literally like sobbing by the time we got home.
I'm sorry you had to deal with that. Do you dread 9/11 because of those kinds of possibilities?
I dread when 9/11 is discussed in a very general overview and there's not enough time for people to reflect on it. Like earlier this week, we had a moment of silence during school, and I thought that was really good to have. I was concerned about if anything would happen after, just because when 9/11, based on people's experiences, where their families were, how they were affected, they might harbor certain prejudices or certain feelings and certain traumas from that day. And luckily later in my U.S. government politics class, we did talk about 9/11 and what that meant to each of us. However, I was concerned that immediately after, if we were just to talk, say 9/11 happened and then immediately leave, people might be like, oh, that girl's wearing a hijab, she was involved. I think that debriefing notion is super important, and it's not something that should be taken lightly.
I also want to ask you, Samia, given what you've had to deal with at times and some of the fear, the backlash, the stereotyping that Ariel described, even in just casual conversations with fellow Christians, mm-hmm. Ariel, yeah? If there is any sort of hope that I have for the future extremists of any ideology with any political, social mission, et cetera, it's that violence almost always injures their cause. So if you are against abortion, attacking clinics that perform abortions is no way to bring sympathy to your cause. If you are any sort of religious faith, attacking people of other religious faiths, is no way to bring sympathy. And I'm always hopeful that people will sort of be logical enough to see it, but of course, logic sometimes goes out the window when people are sort of infected by extremism. There's also a long history of bias and prejudice and racism and bigotry in this country that is sort of layered in different ways. I'm curious to know how you sort of assess your feelings about the result of 9/11 in terms of blame. Do you look at the 19 hijackers and think, whatever you think you were, you've injured Islam as you see it in profound ways? Do you blame sort of long-baked bigotry in this country? How do you sort of kind of think about those complexities?
I mean, on most days, it's not necessarily I feel angry at them. I feel disappointed that people would fall into that. That people didn't understand how to evaluate their feelings and how to resolve their conflicts. You know, immediately after the whole situation with being called a derogatory term happened, I was very upset and extremely angry. That was, in that moment, I felt like anybody who had anything to do with, you know, quote unquote radical Islamic terrorism, you know, is totally to blame. But I think there are bad people in all communities. Anybody can be led astray. And I think taking a religion as using that as like an overarching theme in the name of your cause, taking religion, using it as a political term, that is where the real damage becomes done. And the problem that arises afterwards is that most people don't know the difference. If someone sees Sunni and Shia fighting going on, they don't understand what actual Sunni and what actual Shia Islam is. They just see two branches of Islam. They hate each other. This is a violent religion. People see Al-Qaeda identifying themselves as a terrorist Islamic affiliated group. And people can't distinguish the difference that political causes and taking a name in order to gain, you know, more authority and to gain more, inspire more fear and to gain a wider audience, it's hard to tell the difference.
Mm-hmm. Ty, let me ask you from your perspective now as an atheist now, someone who was a pretty strident Christian at the time of 9/11, you sort of re-examined yourself. You're concerned about extreme ideology. I don't ask you this to sort of ask you at all to sort of condemn honest faith, belief, especially among your co-panelists or anybody else. I'm speaking generally. Do you fear that within religious belief systems, it is almost inevitable that some non-zero percentage, even if it's a small number, will become sort of fanatical and possibly violent? That this isn't maybe even unique to Islam or Christianity or Judaism or Hinduism or anything, but that within the way human beings sort of believe, when you've got thousands and then millions and then possibly billions of people who believe something in religious faith, that there's some non-zero population that will become violent and that that is inevitable. Do you fear that?
Yeah. Yeah, I kind of do. And I think going off what we just heard, that part of the problem is that nobody just has a religion. People tie religion to a political ideology or to a social movement that they seem to think needs to happen. And so it's less that I think it's inevitable coming from religion. I think it's inevitable coming from humans.
So on that idea then, if religion was not a thing, and we will probably never see a world where there is no religious belief. I mean, that's just not the nature of human beings. But let's just sort of presuppose that right now, that there was a bunch of skeptical humanists, billions of skeptical humanists, who thought about the universe in different ways, but not in any sort of religious belief system. Do you think that there would be less violence of the kind that we see on 9/11, or perhaps in ostensibly religious motivated attacks, or would human beings find other reasons to do that?
Oh, that's difficult to answer. I do think there's a component of the origin of a lot of religions, despite their now sort of global reach, mm-hmm. Is in a very specific time and place in history, and it is shaped, like we all are, by that sort of spatio-temporal, existence. And while I think a lot of religions have evolved and changed and adapted to a much broader global sort of sensibility, there is a particular sort of like tribalist origin there. That said, I think people stake sort of tribal claims on all sorts of stuff, whether they like superhero movies or not. It's wild what people will...
Race?
Yeah, sure.
Sexuality?
Mm-hmm.
Where people grew up, nationalism. I mean, that's mm-hmm. it's a wide range. We're talking about how the world has changed post 9/11, particularly for people who are either just born and did not get to grow up in a world before 9/11, or for people who are just moving into adulthood, 17, 18, 19 years old at the time of 9/11, and then almost immediately saw the world somewhat differently and saw certain things change. You just heard Ty Gagnon, who's 36 years old, and you heard Samiha Islam, who's a senior at Brighton High School, was not born on 9/11. Arielle Mahoney was just about one on 9/11. She's a sophomore at Nazareth College now at the age of 19. Sarir Fazali has a daughter who was born about a year after 9/11, and he was 31 years old, embarking on a career in law, and then saw a lot of his own perspective on how the American legal system might be used or sort of co-opted, change post 9/11. We're going to get some of your feedback as well after our only break of the hour here. Coming up in our second hour, new Pew research indicates that support for same-sex marriage is almost the exact same number, 61%, as the number of opposition 15 years ago. So the numbers have flipped. We're going to talk about what's changed in our society with a couple, Barb Adams and Roz Pallara, who were married to men and had children and grandchildren that are living their authentic lives. They'll talk about what's changed next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Ken writes to us via Facebook, says 9/11 was 1 month before my 17th birthday, the beginning of my senior year of high school. Over the next few months, I turned 17. I enlisted in the Army, which you could do at 17 with parents co-signing. And then I graduated. My 18th birthday was spent in basic training and finally getting my first duty station with the 3rd Infantry Division at Fort Stewart, Georgia. When I arrived there, my unit was already in Iraq, and I was told I would join them within days and called my parents to let them know. While, of course, we knew a deployment was certain when I enlisted, it was still a bit of a surprise at how fast it seemed to be happening and never an easy conversation to have with your parents. Fortunately, the decision was made not to send me individually because the unit was going to be coming back in 3 months. When they returned, I was eager to hear firsthand what was happening and hopefully that we were making America safer. I was surprised to hear from nearly every rank-and-file soldier that I talked to. Well, they knew that Saddam was a bad guy, but they had serious questions, to put it lightly, about why we had invaded Iraq amid any lack of connection to 9/11. I was still very young, but hearing directly from soldiers who just got back from a year in Iraq and the very beginning of the war was a jarring realization that our military engagements around the world were a lot more complex than just self-defense. As a teenager after 9/11, during my time in the Army, and still today, I have great respect for those who enlist to serve our country, but that respect of national service makes me even more upset when it is misused. I believe our political leaders need to show greater restraint and not put lives on the line unless it is the last resort of self-defense. That's from Ken. Sarir, you saw, as you said, in your own legal career, a pretty quick change after 9/11 to how things could be co-opted in different ways. And here's Ken saying he's becoming an adult. 9/11 happens. He decides he wants to enlist. And pretty quickly, he starts to feel like the military might be co-opted in ways that he didn't expect. Do we still see those lessons and so those concerns today? And maybe are you ever confident that we will see a world where we don't have those concerns?
You know, there's a famous saying that says, in every crisis, there's an opportunity. And I can tell you, at least for the adult population Muslims after 9/11, the opportunity was for us, number one, to learn much, much more about our own religion, and then the call to action to educate our friends and maybe even then people who are not our friends, so that they knew what we were all about and how we should be reacting. The ability to learn yourself and then to educate people about different things is so important. You know, here you have a gentleman who almost was self-taught. There was a tremendous crisis in America. There was a frenzy of nationalism. People were called to arms, and it was a difficult time to be an American, especially somebody whose blood ran overseas, regardless of your religion or whatever. If you didn't have a flag in your car or outside your house, you were bringing attention to yourself. And when you hear someone talking like this, where within 3 or 4 months after enlistment and people were coming back from Iraq, and it was such a surprise that America was invading Iraq when they ostensibly had no connection to this event, that the education started from the people that had been sent to fight, and they came home and they were telling their own people, we're a little confused as to why we were sent. These days, we have many more such opportunities to try to calm the waters before the waters get rough. And we try to explain to people on any number of issues. It doesn't have to be something like terror or, you know, fighting or whatever, that why don't we look at it through a different prism so that you can see where and why and how things are happening. And it's not necessarily that we're off for fighting terror or the war against terror or for freedom. Oftentimes it could be the tail wagging the dog. And we want to be careful and be able to have just a civil conversation about it so that somebody hears another side. I think after all this, after all of the groups and communities became active and involved, it's happening.
Hmm. Ariel?
Yes.
You know, you weren't cognizant of what was really going on in 2003 when the United States invaded Iraq, and Ken's point about what he learned about his own enlistment. But what have you learned either in school or from others about what that war in Iraq was about? I mean, you're 19 years old now. What's your understanding of the war in Iraq that began in 2003?
I think it was about fear. Again, fear was instilled into people, and they jumped the gun. And they were scared and were trying to make the American people feel better and safer. But out of emotion, you make irrational decisions, and I think that that was an irrational decision. And we're all not perfect. They had good intention. They were trying to help America, but they were hurting people, innocent people. And I think that was a big problem. I feel like that also brewed anger from other communities, and more fear past the event, past 9/11. It extended the fear from 2001 to 2003, and now we're in 2019, and the fear is still there in more subtle ways, mm-hmm. Through stereotypes and whatever the case. So
it's interesting you say that. Lisa on Twitter says, it seems like we're all way more obsessed with post-apocalyptic fiction than we used to be. I am. Feeling safe in public space has evaporated and never returned, and not just because of terrorists, but because of discrimination too, fear of the other. Samia, when you think about the war in Iraq, you know, going back to Ken's point about what he discovered when he was, you know, becoming an adult, enlisting, wanting to serve the country post 9/11, and then sort of what sounds like a disillusionment there. I remember watching the national debate in the days and weeks after 9/11 in 2001, and there was a Democrat, ostensibly a Democrat, he ended up speaking at a Republican National Convention, named Zell Miller from Georgia. He had been a senator and a governor. And if I remember correctly, and I'm sure the people behind the glass will dig this up, but I mean, because I haven't seen it in years, but Zell Miller stood on the floor of the Senate screaming, we should bomb the hell out of Afghanistan. Bomb the hell out of them. There was this sort of retributive bloodlust. That was in the days and weeks after 9/11. And of course, the invasion of Afghanistan happened. But then Iraq wasn't until 2003. So Ken writes to us. He's 18, he enlists, he ends up serving and hearing all these stories. What did you learn growing up about, not necessarily just Afghanistan, but Iraq, what that was about? And how do you understand that today, Samia?
So if I'm being totally honest, yeah. I feel like I've heard two different perspectives on this. I see, last year I took U.S. history in school, and what's in the textbook is different than what I've learned about in my religious schools, like on the weekends. When I hear about it in school, it's, you know, there was a crisis. The U.S. had to get involved. It was for the safety of the Iraqi people, and it was to ensure that they would never be a threat to the U.S. It was a national, it was a necessity. It had to happen. In my religious schools, whenever it's brought up, you know, everybody kind of looks down. Everybody, you know, feels disappointed. Everybody just starts, the air in the room gets a little bit heavy. There's not really, it's not totally justified. It is the aftermath of a long series of Islamophobia. And this is kind of how Islamophobia becomes perpetuated on a much larger scale. Because the justification for invading Iraq, honestly, wasn't there. And so when we know this was 2 years after 9/11, I don't think that Al-Qaeda hadn't been killed by then. So America is still vengeful. The citizens still want their ending. And so if they can't find in Afghanistan, what's the next best Muslim country to go for? And the Muslim world today is so broken. It's so tarnished. It's fragile. And the touch of the United States in those kind of international affairs is something that almost everyone that goes to my mosque is an immigrant, and almost every one of them will have something different to say about it, and none of them would likely be positive.
Our thanks to Behind the Glass, Emma Ray, Megan Mack, producer, and our intern kind of digging up just the actual quote from the New York Times. This is what Senator Zell Miller, Democrat of Georgia, said. And if you watch the actual video, I mean, he's screaming when he says this. He says, I say bomb the hell out of them. If there's collateral damage, so be it. They certainly found our civilians to be expendable. End quote. Ty, you are 18. when he said that. And there were a lot of people, and he was a Democrat, and there were a lot of people who agreed with that. You've never had, you know, your adult life has basically been, America's been at perpetual war somewhere. And the interesting thing for you and me, I'm a little older than you, not much, is that Americans, you ask a lot of Americans and they'll say, no, no, like, we're not at war. There's this idea that we will always have troops deployed and troops dying and troops killing people and engaging in operations, but not even really considering it war, that I find bizarre and really dangerous. But that was sort of born anew, but really born there post 9/11. What's your thoughts about sort of perpetual war that kind of came right at when you're on the brink of adulthood?
For me, this was very scary because at 18, I had to register for the draft. And which I did not want to do. And so to have an attack happen was in and of itself pretty scary. But to see that type of response, or to hear that type of response from people who are supposed to be leading the country, I think was just as scary, that I might just get pulled out of my life to go fight a war that doesn't make any sense to fight. And that I would be used as a tool by particular political powers to do violence that they simply just wanted to do. And so, yeah, I'm just as scared of some of those responses, because I remember seeing Zell Miller on the floor. I think those are just as terrifying as the attacks in some ways.
I can't help but watch that clip and think, to the extent that the terrorists had a goal of luring America into sort of perpetual war, that was, do you need any more evidence that they were effective at that moment? You know, this idea of instantly convincing someone that it's okay to kill innocent civilians because so what they did was an amazing moment. Sort of immediately abandon any idea of moral superiority, but that was sort of part of that moment too. Alex writes, how quickly we forget Saddam was a brutal dictator who blatantly used chemical weapons against dissenters. In Saddam's Iraq, your guests would be in prison or worse. Sarir, what do you say to Alex?
I say that if I look at Iraq today and what it was before the invasion, and I ask Americans, both the citizenry as well as our elected leadership, to take a look and see what it is today and what it was then, I think it's going to be 100% in favor of leave Iraq be. The story of weapons of mass destruction never came out, never had any ground upon which to grow in the first place, and it was a farce. I am all about human rights. Do not get me wrong. How Saddam treated not only his own people, but the people in the neighboring countries, he has to answer for that, and he should have answered for that. The idea that from America we could export justice upon him and his people and the people of Iraq, and we look at what has happened to Iraq today and the cesspool of violence it has become, I don't think I'm in a position to say that I have the authority, moral or otherwise, to remove Saddam or anybody else from his seat in the manner in which it was done. There's a lot of dictators out there. Whether or not they are allegedly democratically elected or not, the violence that they perpetrate on their people and others, we can perhaps have that conversation at another day, but it doesn't give us the right to do what we did in Iraq.
Down to our last minute or so. Samia, do you find yourself wondering what the world will look like if anything similar to 9/11 were to happen again? You know, some kind of attack in some fashion. Because similar to Zell Miller, you heard other political leaders saying we should pave the Middle East. I heard that. I mean, that's kind of rhetoric we heard. Do you fear what the future looks like?
I can already expect it just from the history of what has happened. You know, after World War II, Japanese go into internment camps. After 9/11, Muslims become terrorists. It's you know, when we do the Pledge of Allegiance during school, it's liberty and justice for all. That's what we say. And it's going to be liberty and justice for all at the expense of scapegoat minorities. So is that a fear that I'm waiting to happen, or is it something that I've already come to terms with? I don't know. But I would hope that the way that we're moving today, we can come together in this in a better culture of unity and more tolerance, but I'm hopeful that we can get there in time.
Samia Islam is a senior at Brighton High School. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks to Sarir Fazali, a past president of the Islamic Center of Rochester. Thank you, Sarir.
Thank you.
Ariel Mahoney, sophomore at Nazareth College. Thank you. Good luck to you. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
And Ty Gagnon, who's the local improviser. Thank you, Ty. Nice to have you again.
Thank you.
A lot of powerful perspective this hour, and our thanks to everyone who shared that, whether they're in studio or shared with us on our various platforms. We appreciate that. More connections coming up.